Hi, and welcome to our series on the Kuzari, recorded exclusively for the Orthodox Union's website, OU.org. I'm personally very excited about this recording series because I've spent about the last 15 years or so trying to understand this very important work called the Kuzari by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, which was written in around the year 1140 of the Common Era. It is such an important book about Jewish theology and philosophy, and it has been beloved by every single generation since its writing. I recognize that despite the time that I've put into this study, I've barely scratched the surface in trying to understand what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is trying to convey to us. And I therefore begin with humility and my request to you, the listener, to please forgive any transgression of misunderstanding that I may commit in trying to interpret what I understand to be what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is trying to convey. Now, our project over the next little mini shiurim or mini lectures, every lecture will be from about 5 to 15 minutes, little packets of information that are hopefully easily digestible and will give you a pause to be able to consider what we've said before you go on to the next step. Our first several lectures will be to lay the foundation for the study of the text. I'll give some historical context, I'll give some philosophical and theological context, and so I ask you to please bear with me for the first few lectures before we get actually into the meat of the text. Now, there are certainly many places where we could start our discussion, and sometimes when I lecture on the Kuzari, I end up starting at different places. But for now, what I'd like to start with is just give a brief overview of the history of what is known as the Golden Age of Spanish Jewry, which is approximately from the 10th to the 12th and 13th centuries. I'd actually like to focus on two periods from that time. First, we're going to talk a little bit about what was going on in the 10th century in Spain, and then we're going to shift over to the 12th century, which is when Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the author of this book, The Kuzari, was alive and when he wrote The Kuzari. And I think you'll see shortly why I'm starting two centuries before Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, because really all of the things that we know and what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was able to know about the Khazars, which is the source for the information that he provides in the Kuzari, really began in the 10th century. In Jewish history, the 10th century marks a very important transition point for our people. For those listeners who are B'nai Torah, who study in yeshiva, you understand that this is around the time in history where the Rishonim, the period of the Rishonim, is beginning, the medievalists, the medieval commentaries on the Talmud, the medieval commentaries on Jewish ideology and philosophy are beginning to coalesce in European countries. Why does this mark the beginning of a new era, the 10th century? A lot of it has to do with a tremendous amount of migration that took place en masse between the Middle East moving over to Europe. In other words, a lot of the vast majority of the Jewish community moved from where they were living in Babel, in Babylon, and completely migrated over to various different countries in the European continent. Now, there are a number of reasons why this migration took place, and there's a lot of speculation and a lot of very rich history about this period. It is what we would call the transition point between the period of the Gaonim to the period of the Rishonim. The word Gaonim refers to a system of Torah governance over the Jewish communities in Babel, in Babylon. That is to say that the Jewish communities in Babel had great centers of Torah study, and these Torah centers were presided over their respective Rosh Yeshiva, who were known as Gaonim. And there are many, many famous names and many famous works that were recorded during the period of the Gaonim. But something happened to these Jewish communities, and it really came to a head sometime in the 10th century, where the last of the Gaonim basically faded out. And one of the reasons why this took place is because of the advent of a certain kind of Islam. Islam as a religion had begun in the 7th century with the founder of the Islamic faith, Muhammad, and he had very rapidly gained a tremendous following. But part of Islamic religious doctrine was domination and conquest of as much land mass as possible. And part of that land conquest included in it the conversion of all of the inhabitants of those places which were now controlled by Muslim soldiers, and trying to, in many different kinds of ways, to convert them and have them accept the Islamic faith. Early on in the process of land conquest by the Muslims, they had set up a system of government called a caliphate. And the caliphate represented a seat of authority, a seat of government, for the entire Islamic world empire. By the 10th century, we find that there was a certain kind of caliphate that had established itself in Baghdad, in modern-day Iraq, which is also ancient Babel, which had become increasingly more hostile and less accepting of an autonomous Jewish community. These kinds of Muslims were known as the Abbasids, and they became more and more powerful until they dominated the caliphate in Baghdad. And this made the Jewish community feel increasingly more uncomfortable and unwelcome in the Middle East. And that, coupled with the fact that there were many new economic opportunities in the European continent, caused this mass migration from the Middle East into Europe. Now, under normal circumstances, there was just one caliphate at a time. That means there was, generally speaking, only one seat of government for the entire Muslim world. But something anomalous happened during this time, in that the Abbasids in the Middle East allowed a separate caliphate to exist in Europe. And this was known as the Cordoba Caliphate, which was controlled by a different kind of Muslim. It was controlled by Muslims who had previously shown a sense of tolerance and benevolence towards the Jewish community. These Muslims had also moved their seat of power into Europe, primarily into the southern part of Spain. It's known as the Iberian Peninsula, and in Arabic it was known as Al-Andalus, which was the Arabic name attributed to the Islamic empire that was in this part of the world. Thus began what is now known as the Golden Age of Spanish Jewry, because now the Jews who had fled from the Middle East had come to Europe, came to a place which was much more accepting of them than they had experienced in the 10th century in Babel. And it also offered something to them that other communities in Europe that were under Christian domination did not offer. As you can imagine, in the Christian world, there was a tremendous storm brewing against the Jewish people in the 10th century, which would manifest itself in the 11th century in the form of terrible and horrible crusades in many different places in Europe. This was not going on at this period of time in the Islamic world. To the contrary, in Spain, there was this general acceptance of the Jewish people as being part of an integrated society. As a matter of fact, historians point to a word in Spanish called convivencia, which means a sense of integration between Christians, Muslims, and Jews that was going on at this time. And it was going on at this time specifically in this part of the world, in southern Spain. Now, a lot of historians are careful to emphasize that life was not all peaches and cream for the Jewish people during this time. I think that if we were to compare what was going on back then to 21st century standards, we would be very disappointed to discover that the Jewish people were still being treated as second-class citizens. You may even be familiar with the term called dhimmi, which is an Arabic word to designate a second-class citizen status of an infidel or someone who is not a Muslim. Granted, there were certain limitations that were placed upon people who practiced Judaism, but nevertheless, they were not a persecuted class. As long as you didn't speak out against Islam and against the Prophet Muhammad, you were accepted and you were allowed to actually have a great degree of freedom and even economic and political opportunity. There's one more very important thing that contributed to this period being known as the Golden Age of Spanish Jewry. And it marks a very important distinction between the Islamic world and the Christian world during this time, during the 10th century. Muslims at this time, ironically, looking at it in retrospect, regarded themselves as great intellectuals and indeed the torchbearers of Greek philosophy. Now, later on, we're going to spend a significant amount of time trying to provide some basic principles of Greek philosophy, because it's going to be necessary for us to at least have a thumbnail sketch of some Greek philosophical concepts in order to understand a book like the Kuzari, and it'll certainly be helpful for us to have this knowledge to understand other works like the Rambam's Moreh Nevuchim, The Guide for the Perplexed. But for now, suffice it to say that the Islamic world overall was a very scholastic society, was very involved and interested in academic and intellectual pursuits, and therefore welcomed the Jewish community to join them in these intellectual pursuits. Now, as you can probably imagine, this is sometimes a double-edged sword. Anytime there's a period of great acceptance and tolerance for Jews in the diaspora, there's a tremendous opportunity for the Jewish community to flourish and to grow, both in prosperity and intellectually and religiously. But at the same time, there's also a tremendous danger of assimilation, of the Jewish people becoming disenchanted and disaffected by Judaism because they're more attracted to the trappings of the external society that is so welcoming to them and sometimes seems to offer more than what a parochial Judaism has to offer. There were great Islamic philosophers throughout this period, this medieval period, names like Al-Farabi, Avicenna, Averroes, names that you may have heard about when studying medieval philosophy. These are Arabs and Persian Muslims who cropped up during this time. They subscribed almost completely to a type of philosophy, an Aristotelian philosophy, which was very attractive to the world at this time, because it appeared to be able to offer answers to ultimate questions about the meaning of life, about the all of existence, about God, and so forth. So as you can probably imagine, this presented something that was very attractive to the Jewish community, but at the same time perhaps may have posed somewhat of a threat in presenting itself as a way of the Jewish community pulling itself away from Jewish doctrine and Jewish teachings and being drawn towards this new kind of ideology that was presenting itself in such an attractive and welcoming way. And I think looking at this period of history from a 21st century lens, I think you can probably appreciate the irony of thinking about the Islamic world as the great bastion of intellect and of intellectual study and scholasticism. Because when we look at the Islamic world today, we see almost the exact opposite. We associate it with a world of religious fanaticism and fundamentalism, and not really a rational society. And the Christian world at that time in the 10th century was really more involved with barbarism and mysticism and magic and a suppression of scholastic pursuits. So it's interesting, isn't it, how history sometimes does flip-flops, and it's interesting to trace these kinds of patterns. The last point I'd like to make about the Islamic world at this time is that we're going to find that it was not monolithic in its approach or its attitude towards Greek philosophy. There were many great Islamic philosophers at this time who completely subscribed to the writings of Aristotle and those who interpreted him. There were other Islamic thinkers who were more apologists for the Islamic faith. That is to say, they did study philosophy, and when they found a contradiction between something that was taught by Aristotle and something that was taught in the Quran by the Prophet Muhammad, they would try to find some way of reconciling what seemed to be an apparent contradiction. These were known as the Mutakallimun, the masters of wise words, and they exercised a certain kind of dialectic approach called kalam, and it was a way of trying to make sure that people stayed faithful to Islam and understood that there was a way of reconciling it with Greek philosophy. There were other great Muslim thinkers, and these thinkers really completely rejected Greek philosophy. They said there's no need to reconcile it, and it's going to only lead us astray. It's a foreign god. Let's just stick with the fundamentals. One of the famous names of this period was a man by the name of Al-Ghazali, who wrote a lot about condemning the philosophers of his time, his Muslim contemporaries who were engaged in this kind of philosophical endeavor. And it seems that Al-Ghazali seems to have won the battle, because after this golden age that we're talking about right now, several centuries later, the Islamic world seems to have fallen off the philosophical wagon, as it were, and descended into its own religious fundamental approach. And that's why, although during this golden age we find that the Islamic world really held its head high as being the great mathematicians and scientists of the world and really sharing with this world this great enlightenment, we find that this waned tremendously in the Islamic world after this period of time, specifically because there came a point when they could no longer reconcile the Islamic faith and Greek philosophy. Now, the reason I raise this at the very outset is because we're going to perhaps see the similar kind of tension in the Jewish world. When we talk about Greek philosophy, we're going to see that people like Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and like the Rambam and like many of their contemporaries feel a need to engage in this kind of intellectual approach and see if it fits within Judaism. And we may find the same patterns of tension of some people embracing it, some people rejecting it within Jewish thought as well. But that's a subject for later as we go through the text. We're going to have to hold it here because I'm already going over time, but our first stop during the 10th century will be with a very great Jew, Rabbi Chasdai ibn Shaprut, who was the vizier to the caliph, the head of the Cordoba Caliphate at the time, a man by the name of Abd al-Rahman III, and his successor, Caliph Hakim. Chasdai ibn Shaprut was also a rabbi. He was the Nasi. He was the rabbinical leader of the Jewish community of Cordoba. And he is where our story is going to begin, because he is the first of the mainstream Jewish community who communicated with the Jewish Khazars, which really forms the foundation framework of the book that we're studying now called the Khuzari. His correspondence with the Khazar king, which would later become known as the Chasdai letters, formed the historical groundwork for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's work. And we'll discuss the Chasdai letters in our next talk. Thanks for joining us.